Welcome to session 109 of the Bible in a Year commentary. If you started this series on the 1st of January, then today should be the 19th of April. Today we'll be looking at Isaiah 1 to 4 and Psalm 109. But first of all, let's get an overview of Isaiah. If we were reading the Bible cover to cover, then the next books we'd look at would be 1st and 2nd Chronicles. However, for our reading plan, we're going to save those for the end of the Old Testament, as they serve as a full recap of the story so far before moving on to the New Testament. Instead, we're going to focus on some of the prophets, namely those speaking before the exile. With that said, there will be some prophets like Isaiah, whose writings expand into the post-exilic era. Isaiah can be split into two halves. The first half, Isaiah 1 to 39, is focused on Isaiah speaking to the people before the exile, warning them of what is to come and framing it in light of what God is doing. The second half, Isaiah 40 to 66, is speaking to a people after the exile and providing them with a hope of what God will do next. Isaiah wouldn't have been alive after the exile, so what is most likely happening is that the second half of Isaiah was written by disciples of Isaiah who have passed down Isaiah's teachings and are now repurposing them for a post-exilic people. Here's a summary of the structure, but I would recommend checking out the written version of the commentary in the description to see the structure properly for yourself, particularly as today there are two. But we start in Isaiah 1 to 12, which is about judgment and hope for Jerusalem. That can be broke up in Isaiah 1 to 5. The old Jerusalem will be purified with judgment to make way for the new Jerusalem. Isaiah 6, which is Isaiah's temple vision. And then Isaiah 7 to 12, Isaiah rebukes Ahaz and prophesies a new king. Then we have Isaiah 13 to 27, which is the judgment and hope for the nations. Within that, there's Isaiah 13 to 23, the fall of Babylon and Israel's neighbours. And then Isaiah 24 to 27, a tale of two cities, the lofty city destined for ruin and the new Jerusalem. Then we have Isaiah 28 to 39, the rise and fall of Jerusalem. Within that, there's Isaiah 28 to 35, accusations of Jerusalem's leaders. Isaiah 36 to 38, the rise of Hezekiah. And then Isaiah 39, Hezekiah's fall. And then finally, we move to Isaiah 40 to 66, the hope after exile. And within that, there's Isaiah 40 to 48, hope is announced, but the people reject it. Isaiah 49 to 55, the servant fulfills God's missions. And then Isaiah 56 to 66, the servants inherit God's kingdom. Isaiah was a prophet who lived in Jerusalem in the final period of Judah's history before their exile. He spanned the reigns of Ahaz and Hezekiah. His book is a collection of preaches and visions that Isaiah had that have been reorganized or repurposed and adapted by his later disciples. These have been put into one book. Because of this, you might find that this book gets repetitive. This will likely be because originally these were individual standalone preaches that have later been collected together. Instead of thinking, oh, I've read this already, see if you can recognise these themes and how each vision or preach builds upon these themes and uses them. His teachings have two key themes. First, to warn the people of the impending judgment that God is going to bring on them for their rebellion and for the injustice and oppression that is rife in their society. Secondly, to encourage and provide hope that God will remain faithful to his covenant promises. Promises like a future king from the line of David, we saw in 2 Samuel 7. To make the Israelites an obedient and priestly kingdom for himself, as we saw back in Exodus 19 verses 5 to 6. And to use the Israelites to bless the nations, Genesis 12 verses 1 to 3. With the splitting of the kingdom into northern Israel and southern Judah, it becomes difficult to understand when someone is using Israel to refer to the northern kingdom and when they're using Israel to refer to the nation as a whole. Each of the prophets has their own way of addressing this problem. For Isaiah, whenever he mentions Israel, he's referring to the nation as a whole. Sometimes he calls them by Jacob instead. When he wants to talk about the northern kingdom, he calls them Ephraim. And then his favourite name for Jerusalem is Zion. So that's the primary name you'll see through his writings. But let's jump in with today's reading, Isaiah 1 to 4. In the first vision, Isaiah sees how the people have turned from God and been sinful. They no longer know who he is. He notes that they are rotten through and through, from the tops of their head to the bottom of their feet. In the north, the cities have been burnt and foreign armies plunder the land. All that is left is Jerusalem, who is routinely besieged. Even when the people do focus on God and offer him sacrifices, it's only as a token gesture. They're still living sinful lives day to day. God is not interested in their sacrifices. Instead, he wants them to change their ways, to stop sinning, to learn to do good, to seek justice, deal with oppression, and care for those in need. God's plan is clear. If the people won't clean themselves from their sin and practice obedience, he will remove them and purge them with fire, so that only a pure Jerusalem remains. In the second vision, Isaiah sees a future Zion, a new city on the top of a mountain. And that city will be a place where people live right, which spreads peace and helps the rest of the world deal with their disputes. Instead, the house of Jacob, that is, the nation of Israel as a whole, is currently fat and greedy. It is filled with so much wealth, so many horses, and so many idols. It has put its trust in those things and not in God. But there will come a day that God has prepared where he will come against all these things and he will destroy them. The people of God will cast away all their idols on that day because they will fear God. God will take his support away from his people. He will no longer provide for them and they will be left with nothing. The situation is going to be so bad that if someone has a cloak, then they're worthy of being king because no one else has a cloak. They will be desperate for good leadership because God is no longer leading them. Then God will judge the elders, the kings and the leaders of the nation for leading his people poorly and not protecting the weak. He is also judging his people for their promiscuity. Just in the same way as a woman might cheat on her husband and sleep around with whoever, the people have cheated on God by worshipping whatever foreign idol or god picks their fancy. But after all this judgment and destruction, there will come a branch from the Lord. This idea of a branch will come up a lot. This branch will be beautiful, good to look at, and will provide the land with much fruit. This is a callback to the Garden of Eden, where there were trees that were good to look at and bared fruit, back in Genesis 2 verse 9. During that time, God will cleanse his people to make them holy, and they will rest again in the city, free from any more destruction and judgment. These early chapters set up a key theme of the book. God will purify his people with judgment. It will be painful, much like silver passing through fire. But the end result is that God will have a city and a people who are loyal and faithful to him. That's Isaiah 1 to 4. But now let's jump in with Psalm 109. This psalm is attributed to King David and falls into the category of Lament Psalm. Here's a summary of that structure. Verses 1 to 5, cry to God and the initial complaint. Verses 6 to 19, how the wicked talk about the psalmist. Verses 20 to 31, the psalmist asks for rescue and for the enemies to get what they deserve. The psalmist opens with a cry to God. Do not be silent, O God. They then bring their complaint. The wicked have come against them. They lie about the psalmist, cursing them and attacking them. The psalmist tries to be good and loving, and in return, they are accused and hated. The psalmist then goes into a long section explaining exactly what the enemies are saying about them. They seek to falsely accuse the psalmist and to rig their trial to make sure they are found guilty. They seek the psalmist's downfall, wanting to see the psalmist die, their wife become a widow, and their children orphans. May the bailiffs come and take all that the psalmist has so that the children have nothing. The psalmist's enemies appeal to the mistakes the psalmist's parents made as justification for why the psalmist must deserve death. They then make claims about the psalmist's behaviour. The psalmist was unkind and oppressive to the poor and needy. They regularly cursed those around them. Finishing explaining what their enemies had said, the psalmist asked that all of this be turned back onto their enemies. They then turn to the Lord, asking for his support because of his steadfast love. They are weak and failing. So help, O Lord. Let all that accuse the psalmist see that God is on their side. Let the accusers be filled with shame while the psalmist praises God for his goodness. When reading this psalm, it can feel at odds with the New Testament call to love your enemies. Have a look at Matthew 5, verse 44. But in fact, we've read many similar calls in the Old Testament to love your enemies. See Exodus 23, verses 4 to 5, and Leviticus 19, verses 17 to 18. One argument for this is that the psalmist is concerned primarily with justice. They don't want to see a society where wicked people are able to hound and oppress the innocent. So not only does the psalmist want to see themselves rescued by God, they want to make sure that no one else has to suffer at the hands of these wicked people. In our own prayers, we have to balance these two things, loving our enemies and wanting to see injustice end.